More than 20 years ago, the Libyan writer Hisham Matar's father disappeared. His father was an opponent of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi and was in exile when he was kidnapped. He hasn't been seen since. Just as Gaddafi's regime was collapsing this summer, Hisham Matar published a novel about an exile who's kidnapped. Anatomy of a Disappearance is told from the point of view of the victim's son.
All that I did not know about my father, his private life, his thoughts, why he was kidnapped and by whom, what he had actually done to provoke such actions, where he was at this moment, whether he could be counted among the living or the dead, was like a mask that suffocated me. I felt guilty, too, as I continue to feel today, at having lost him, at not knowing how to find him or take his place. Every day I let my father down.
Hisham Matar, reading from Anatomy of a Disappearance, his new novel. He's in our studios. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
The passage that you read is the memory of a young man who doesn't know where his father is now. And, in fact, you choose to tell this story through a 14-year-old. He's 14 at the time of the kidnapping, which means he knows even less. He's not really sure what it was his father was doing that was making anybody angry. He's not really sure who kidnapped him, although it's believed that a Gaddafi-like government kidnapped him. Why tell the story that way?
I think ultimately, you know, one of the ways into contemporary Middle Eastern history is to use the construct of the father and son.
What do you mean?
The older generation, the generation of the father, were the audacious ones, the ones that were reckless politically and had these high dreams and didn't blush when they spoke about it. My generation were the generation that were restrained, the generation that was shy about speaking about these things.
You're saying your father's generation was the one that dreamed of modernizing and bringing ahead the Middle East and building a new world. And that younger people, people of your age, and how old are you, may I ask?
I'm 40.
People of your generation went along with the dictators who ended up in charge of these various countries for a long time.
Well, everybody went along, but I do sense, and I have sensed since I was very young, that I'm part of a generation that isn't as audacious as the generation before. A generation, and actually I think that lack of audacity is not such a bad thing. I think my generation's inability to speak in absolute terms when it comes to politics is a very positive thing. It's made us more nuanced, made us more complex. Now we see that the newer generation, the generation of the present revolutions, you know, one of the nicknames of the Libyan revolution is the revolution of the young men in falling jeans.
So they are people 10 or 20 or even 25 years younger than you.
Exactly. Yeah. And that it seems like audacity had skipped a generation.
Now, what have you thought as you have watched the revolution specifically in your country? I think you told someone a few months ago you're consumed by this story.
It's a moment of dramatic transition. It's embedded in it also a great deal of uncertainty and anxiety. But what is certain is that people have glimpsed another possibility. They have just a very quick glimpse of what it might be to live in a just and dignified way. And that might take a long time to be realized, but I believe that once you see that, once a people see that, it's impossible to erase it.
When was the last time you were in Libya?
My family left Libya in 1979, so I haven't been to Libya in 32 years.
How vivid are your memories of your childhood in Libya?
Very vivid. You know, as a writer, I know that some of the most powerful memories are those when you are very, very young. After that, everything becomes, it's as if sort of seen through a reflection. You know, adult life is seen through the reflection of complex rational thoughts, you know. Yeah. Whereas when you're young, it's so immediate, and a lot of the sensations are for the first time. So it's very vivid, but it's also abstract. So there's always a question of, you know, why didn't you get over it? You know, if you were a sensible human being, you wouldn't be thinking about Libya anymore. But I'm not sensible. I'm deeply involved with Libya for many reasons. I think mostly because I'm in love with it, but also because my family history is so intertwined with the country.
So you left the country in 1979 because your father had disagreements with the regime. And you lived abroad in Cairo, if I'm not mistaken. Your father was picked up in 1990.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, after we left Libya, my father became a very vocal opponent to the Gaddafi regime. And we lived in Egypt, which was a safe place for people who were on the wrong side of the Libyan dictatorship, up to the late 80s, when they started to become friends, but also they realized that they could help each other.
The Mubarak dictatorship in Egypt and the Gaddafi dictatorship in Libya.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the things that they did was to hand over dissidents that were residing in each other's countries. So my father was a victim of that. He was kidnapped by the Egyptian secret services, and he effectively disappeared. And we later found out that he was sent to Libya, where he was tortured and imprisoned, never subjected to a trial, so we don't even know what he's technically accused of. And the dictatorship continued until its end to deny this fact, and the Egyptian dictatorship also.
Could your father still be alive in Libya somewhere?
It's a possibility. You know, it's impossible to give up hope until you know, really. I recently went to a fishing village in Ireland. And it's the only place I went to where I found people that feel exactly the same way as I do about my father. There are several fishermen who had disappeared, you know, because they fish on their own on these tiny boats, very high sea. So I met this lady who's about my age. When she was 8 years old, her father went out to earn his keep and he never returned. She can't entirely give up hope that he's somehow alive, you know. On some level, it seems a far clearer situation. Sea, man, never seen again. And it illustrates also how hope, living in hope, is a really terrible thing. I mean, people speak about hope most of the time as a very positive thing. And I understand why, and it's become sort of entered into political language and so on. But really, if you stop and think about the state of living in hope, it's a very dispossessing thing. It's a very difficult thing to live with. So when you've been living in hope for a long time, as I have, suddenly you realize that certainty is far more desirable than hope. Desirable than hope.
Hisham Mattar is the author of In the Country of Men and his new novel, Anatomy of a Disappearance. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Adam Mansbach is the author of a popular children's book for adults. It's about the struggle many parents have getting their kids to sleep. We can't actually say the whole title of the book on the radio, but it's essentially Go to Sleep, plus a vulgarity to get the point across. Mansbach recently revisited some of his childhood favorites, and he found to his surprise that they're still just as good as he remembers. Here he is for our series, Three Books.
If there's anything the writers I know share besides an unhealthy relationship to caffeine, it's a childhood spent immersed in books. All my young adult favorites look more like accordions than novels, because they've been dropped into the bathtub so many times. They're also seared into my consciousness like few novels I've read since. I used to chalk that up to the impressionability of youth, until I started revisiting those stories and realizing how well they stand up as literature. The ones I continue to love now tend to confront complex social issues bravely, convey emotions with tremendous empathetic clarity, and rest on compelling narrative voices. In other words, the very elements that draw me into novels today. In Bruce Brooks' The Moves Make the Man, it's 1961, and Wilmington, North Carolina's white junior high school has just been integrated by exactly one student, our narrator Jerome Foxworthy, the J-Fox. Deeply observant, wise beyond his years, and a basketball prodigy, the J-Fox befriends a troubled classmate. Bix is a baseball star who needs to master basketball in order to confront his stepfather and gain access to his institutionalized mother. But the concept of faking, though central to the game, is anathema to Bix's radical notion of honesty. Not only does this book deserve a place in the pantheon of great American race novels, it also features some of the most astute sports writing I've ever read. For the Carnegie-esque Pittsburgh Clan in Father's Arcane Daughter by E.L. Konigsberg, time stopped years ago when the family's eldest daughter was kidnapped. Now a grown woman claiming to be the long-gone Caroline has returned. She's embraced by the family, even as doubts linger in the mind of her young half-brother Winston. Soon it becomes clear that Caroline is there to unlock the cage of fear in which Winston and his younger sister have been forced to live. Atmospheric but never stuffy, this is a finely wrought mystery, as well as a meditation on the truths we choose to live with and the truths we choose to live without. The narrator of John LeVert's The Flight of the Cassowary is a teenage boy with a keen interest in biology and a pet theory about evolution, that all the instincts and abilities we possessed as more primitive creatures are still inside us somewhere, waiting to be called to action. His friends and family don't take it very seriously, until he starts accessing those talents, catching and re-catching a fly with froggish reflexes, summoning gazelle-like speed during a football game, and then channeling more aggressive powers when his skills gain him unwanted attention. LeVert juggles belief and disbelief, science and humor, pathos and romance, with the dexterity of a... what kind of animal can juggle? Returning to these three books reminds me of why I fell in love with reading. Pick one up and lose yourself in it. Why should kids have all the fun?
Adam Mansbach is author of the book Go the Blank to Sleep. For more on his reading recommendations, you can go to our website, npr.org. Now, a talk with Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist, about his new book. But first, this historical analogy made on this program earlier this year by Paul Otellini, the CEO of Intel. Our country's situation today, Otellini said, is like Britain's situation at the turn of the last century.
The UK, 100 years ago, was where America was. I imagine sitting in Britain 110 years ago, looking at the rising giant of the United States. The buildings going up and the new factories and the schools and the universities. And they must have been saying, oh, my God. And in fact, the U.S. eclipsed the U.K. and most of Europe. Well, we're sitting here today looking over the next ocean, the Pacific this time, and the infrastructure being built out in Asia, not just China, but across Asia. And we should be appropriately saying, oh, my God.
Oh, my God could well have been the title of the new book that Thomas Friedman and Michael Mandelbaum have written. It's called That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented, and How We Can Come Back. Tom Friedman, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Robert.
What you're describing here is a country that used to be industrially advanced, exceptionally inventive, unusually educated, politically pragmatic, relatively egalitarian. Today we look around and say, that used to be us. Other countries are more like that now.
Well, there's no question we've lost our way, Robert. And what Michael and I argue in the book is that it's really the product of three big things. It's not the 2008 subprime crisis. This problem started at the end of the Cold War. We made the biggest mistake a country or species can make. We misread our environment. We thought the Cold War was a victory and we could put our feet up. In fact, we had just unleashed a world of 2 billion people just like us. People with our same aspirations, same capabilities. And just when we needed to be lacing up our shoes and running faster, we put our feet up. We compounded it then, I would add, with a decade, unfortunately, tragically, after 9/11, mm-hmm. where we ended up chasing the losers from globalization for 10 years, Al-Qaeda, rather than the winners.
We were preoccupied, you would say, with the wrong rivals
yes.
During this past decade. Some people might argue this point or that about our decline, but let's stipulate that your description of the national funk or the decline that we're in is accurate. Why? What was going through our minds over the past 20 years that vetoed an older impulse to say, hey, we have to compete economically, we have to save and invest, we have to pay for what we do?
Well, as I say, there was a third factor, and that was a generational change. We shifted from a greatest generation that really operated on what we call in the book sustainable values, saving and investing. And we handed power over to the baby boomer generation who really lived by situational values, borrow and consume. And I think that shift has been a key factor.
But to some extent, we have seen the enemy, and he is... He's our generation.
Oh, it's definitely. The baby boomers, I believe, have a lot to answer for. They have not followed in the path of their parents in terms of making the hard decisions, making the long-term investments. Doubly important at this time of huge technological change. Let me just say a few words about that because it's very important. You know, the world after the Cold War didn't just get connected. It got hyper-connected. And when it did, we were exposed to competition from so many more people, so many more machines, and so many more robots. You know, Robert, I wrote a book and I started in 2004 called The World is Flat. And as I started working on this book, I went back and I reread The World is Flat. Mm-hmm. And I actually looked in the index, first edition. under F. And I realized Facebook wasn't in it. When I wrote The World Was Flat, when I said, the world is flat, you know, we're all connected. Facebook didn't exist. Twitter was a sound. The cloud was in the sky. 4G was a parking place. LinkedIn was a prison. Applications were what you sent to college. And Skype, for most people, was a typo. All of that changed in just the last 6 years.
But here's a problem with the very flatness that you've written about. Your book, the problem it's addressing, is a national concern. You're writing about this country. And I wonder, when you talk to CEOs of large companies whose markets, shareholders, increasingly their labor force, are global and not confined to this country, whether they're on board with the national project, or does the very flat world that you've written about mean that the production of wealth by American-based companies just doesn't benefit as many Americans as it used to, and it may never.
I think that's exactly right. You see, American multinationals today, those big companies we think about, Robert, they actually aren't in America. They hover over America. And we are missing, actually, the voices of those CEOs in our discussions today, our national discussions on education and infrastructure, because if they can't get the workers, the infrastructure, the opportunities they need here, they can just go somewhere else. And that's a huge problem. But I think it gets to what needs to be our vision going forward. There's kind of a hankering today. When is Ford going to put in that 50,000 worker factory in my city again? When is Intel going to come? Paul Otellini. Folks, it's not going to happen because those factories now are all incredibly roboticized, automated, and they are capital intensive, not labor intensive. We're not going to have a 50,000 person factory in your town. What we need are 50,000 people, 1,000 of whom are starting jobs for 10 people, 50 of whom for 100, 100 of whom for 30, that everybody needs to be starting something.
But many of the remedies that you write about here are good in theory, but say having more and better teachers or a National Academy of Teachers is a proposal you're making in a season when in fact we're laying off teachers. A balanced approach to solving our fiscal problems is something you write about, and we know what the fact, the stalemate is in Washington. How do you get from where we are right now to solutions that might indeed address our national problems? What do you do?
Well, we understand the political system is gridlocked. Hmm? You know, I would argue one of our political parties, the Republican Party today in particular, and we are independents, this is not a political book, but they've really gone off the rails in a certain way. And that's why, you know, if you look at what's going on today, Robert, in America, we're having an economic crisis and the politicians are having an election. And it's like they don't even overlap. And what we argue is that's because the incentives of politics today, money, gerrymandered districts, are so misaligned with the needs of the country that they become like a closed circle operating on their own. And something's got to break through that. And what we argue for is an independent third party that actually can show that there is a huge middle in this country that demands a different politics.
You go out of your way to end on an upbeat note in the book and say that you do you really feel optimistic? I mean, do you really look around at Washington and the economy and say, we're going to come out of this okay?
Drugs, Robert. A lot of drugs.
you're self-medicating.
No, it's look, I am truly an optimist. And the reason we don't just end on an optimistic note, we end on a long discussion about what makes us optimists. It's because this country is full of people today who just didn't get the word. They just didn't get the word that we're down and out. They just didn't get the word that Washington is paralyzed. And they go out and start stuff and invent stuff and fix stuff and make stuff no matter what's going on in Washington.
Tom Friedman, thanks for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Thomas Friedman and Michael Mandelbaum are the authors of That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented and How We Can Come Back.
Of all the subjects a first-time novelist might attempt, America in the wake of September 11th would seem like a really unwise choice. It's too ambitious, too fraught, just too much. Fortunately, says book critic Maureen Corrigan, Amy Waldman didn't get that memo. Waldman served as co-chief of the South Asia Bureau of the New York Times, and her short fiction has been published in The Atlantic. Her debut novel, about September 11th, is called The Submission, and Maureen calls it a triumph.
The Submission is a gorgeously written novel of ideas about America in the wake of September 11th. It tackles touchy subjects like identity politics, undocumented immigrants, and the stress fractures of democracy. Maybe the most audacious question that's posed by Amy Waldman's debut novel, however, is the implicit one that lingers long after a reader finishes it. Namely, could it be that a decade after the attacks, America finally has the 9/11 novel, one that does justice, artistically and historically, to the aftershocks of that day? Of course, there have been other serious fiction contenders that have ruminated on September 11th, among them Joseph O'Neill's Netherland, Deborah Eisenberg's short story collection Twilight of the Superheroes, Don DeLillo's Falling Man, and Ken Kalfas's dark tour de force, a disorder peculiar to the country. But the submission distinguishes itself by its panoramic scope and also by the ease with which it pulls off the literary magic trick of being at once poetic and polemical. Arguments about America are hashed out relentlessly on the pages of this novel, and yet Waldman never stints on character development, plot, or the pleasures of her inventive language. Ever the English teacher, I even found myself making lists of all the startling verbs and metaphors Waldman comes up with. For instance, describing a tough woman laughing meanly at another's expense, Waldman writes, "Her laugh burst forth, breaking up her face like jackhammered cement." This is an assured, ambitious novel that appeals to both a reader's senses and intelligence. The central situation here will sound more contrived in my summary than it is in Waldman's execution. Here goes. 2 years after the attacks, a jury of artists, academics, and one non-credentialed civilian, a 9/11 widow, has been convened to sift through some 5,000 blind design entries for a memorial at the site of Ground Zero. In the opening chapter, a winner is chosen. And then the dumbfounded jury learns that their pick is a Muslim American architect named Mohammed Khan. The chief champion of Khan's design was the 9/11 widow, Claire Burwell. Waldman succinctly characterizes Claire's grief for her late husband this way. It had been 2 years. He appeared in her dreams but vanished on waking, and she spoke of him in qualities, positive, ebullient, smart, principled, that had no texture. Claire initially loves the design for a rectangular walled garden as a memorial, especially the fact that it would be composed of both life-affirming greenery as well as steel trees made out of salvaged scraps from the World Trade Center. But as soon as Khan's name is leaked to the public, controversy rages about the identity of the architect and his garden design. It seems Islamic to some critics. In fact, Lou Sarge, a Rush Limbaugh-like radio personality, charges that the garden is Mohammed Khan's sly strategy to construct an Islamic martyr's paradise on Ground Zero. Claire finds herself pressured to rethink her support for the garden. At a raucous public hearing in New York, one bereaved father poignantly states his objections. "We who have carried the weight of loss are now being asked to carry the weight of proving America's tolerance." Khan himself is an aloof guy who doesn't play well to the media. He's outraged that, as an American, he should even be called upon to justify his patriotism. As more and more voices pile into the national debate, the arguments become more complicated. A scholar opines that the World Trade Center towers themselves contained Islamic architectural features. Another 9/11 widow speaks out to ask if there will even be a place for her husband's name on whatever memorial will be built, given that he was one of the many undocumented immigrants who worked at the towers, cleaning bathrooms and hallways. The submission is sure to generate a lot of discussion in book clubs across the land about the promises of democracy. In so doing, Waldman's novel itself serves as a powerful memorial to 9/11 and the struggles of America in its aftermath.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed the submission by Amy Waldman. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org.
And if you like playing with words, then I'm betting you're going to enjoy this next segment, where we explore our love of letters. Well, actually, fonts. For instance, here at NPR, everyone, and I mean everyone's got an opinion on their favorite typeface or font that they want to use to write their radio scripts.
One is Garamond. It's got little feet on it, serifs, you know, and it's a very clear, kind of simple font.
The cleanness, the simplicity of the Gill Sans is what I really like.
One of the questions that was asked of me was, you like Arial, but you like it a specific way. And I always say bold, definitely.
My least favorite is anything that's too squirrely and swirly and busy.
It makes me feel relaxed and possibly even relaxed and in control.
I got to make sure the whole thing is in bold and then I'm ready to go. And I don't know what that says about me.
That was NPR's Susan Stamberg, Peter Overby, and Lakshmi Singh sharing their idiosyncrasies about fonts. The stories behind their favorites, like Garamond and Gill Sans, are told in a new book called Just My Type, A Book About Fonts by Simon Garfield. Garfield spoke to us from the studios of the BBC in London, and we started with his favorite.
You know, I have two favorite fonts. One for text and for my work when I'm writing books is called Georgia. For me, it works because it's quite formal, but also quite soft and rounded. And it has a personal feel, but very readable. But for a display font for a poster or a book jacket, I would choose something called Albertus. And why do I like that? I think it's because it was made in the 1930s by a carver. And he formed these letters that have little legs, what you would call a semi-serif. And Albertus has a lovely, warm, carved feel, and it's also fantastically clear.
There's another font we have to talk about, because you can't talk about fonts without bringing it up, which is Helvetica, which has had a documentary devoted to it. And I think you talk to one guy in your book, you highlight a story where he tries to have a day without Helvetica.
Yeah, he found it almost impossible, really. So he couldn't get up in the morning, you know, he couldn't put on a T-shirt because his T-shirt label instructions had, you know, Helvetica on them. He couldn't use a dollar bill because the numbers are in Helvetica. He couldn't go on the subway, New York's our subway, because that was in Helvetica as well, all the signs. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's really taken over the world. And in fact, Helvetica sort of has a rival now. The rival is called Gotham. And Gotham was the type that was used by Barack Obama in all the election campaign.
So you open the book with a neat little anecdote about a college dropout who decided to take calligraphy classes soon after leaving school. And this is a college dropout who it would be pretty meaningful to the world of fonts.
Yeah, this is Steve Jobs, the man behind Apple. Prior to Mac and then not long afterwards, Microsoft as well, we didn't have access to fonts. And everything basically looked like the typewriter font. So it was a liberating thing in the 80s.
And you spend a lot of time in the book taking what you call font breaks, where you sort of dive into the history of the names behind the fonts. Is there anyone in particular you want to bring up here?
Well, the one I always love is called Doves. And Doves, like the bird, is a fleeting type, very beautifully invented around 1900 by a real aesthete who thought he could invent the perfect, most beautiful type. He formed a publishing house with his partner, but they had a great fallout. And he was absolutely adamant that when he died, his partner wasn't going to use this font. So he took all the letters that had ever been made with Doves and he took them to Westminster Bridge over the Thames and threw them in. He can try and dispose of as much of that as he could, and successfully so.
And that was the end of Doves.
Exactly.
Simon Garfield is the author of Just My Type, A Book About Fonts. He spoke to us from the BBC studios in London. Simon, thanks again.
I really enjoyed it, Audie. Thank you very much.